Okay, I guess I'll start. So first, thanks everyone for being here on a beautiful Saturday morning. And also I would like to thank the organizers. It's my first CYZER, so it's been a great experience. I have learned a lot. Currently I'm moving from Case Western Reserve University to Southern University of Science and Technology. I will move there right after CYZER. So technically, I don't belong to any of these institutions. So using a jargon I'm gonna introduce today, I'm in this partially molten state. So I'm talking about melting and melt, and I had to show a picture of a volcano. I'm kind of forced to do that. This is an image taken a few days ago about the recent eruption at Kilauea volcano in Hawaii. When we see molten lavas on the surface like this, we would wonder there must be some molten rocks inside, but we don't know how deep they come from. In old days, people would just wonder the inside the Earth, it must be very hot. So it's likely maybe everything is molten inside. And actually, this is also quite often the conception of the general public. Quite often when people meet me and they realize I'm an earth scientist, that they will ask, is it molten inside? Are there like magmas inside? Of course, we know this picture is not true. I decided to wear my slide today so that in case people ask me, I can tell them it's different than what you may think. Of course, this is more updated image of the 3D cutaway of Earth. There are a lot of heterogeneities inside. But the first order picture is this, given by the prime model. And we don't see a lot of melting inside, except the outer core. So for the outer core, there is no shear waves that can propagate through, so it must be in the liquid state. However, the majority of the mantle, we do see shear wave propagating through them. So that must be in the solid form. For other planetary cores, it's actually pretty common that the cores are molten in the liquid state form. For example, for Mercury, the Moon, Mars, and this is a Jupiter of a satellite that Ganymede. There are all kinds of geophysical observations suggesting that the cores are molten in these planets. But for the mantle, it's quite different. This is the typical mantle geotherm. As we have learned from Bruce's lecture, the mantle is convecting, so in this layer, we have this adiabatic temperature gradient. But for the top layer, it's a boundary layer, we have this conductive boundary. So because of this, we have a much steeper temperature gradient there. So this curvature decides that this geotherm would not cross the solidus of the mantle rocks. Okay, I'll talk about the solidus later, but it's basically the temperature when you start to melt a rock. But we do see volcanoes on surface of Earth. So how could that happen? It turns out there are a few ways we can make a melt in the Earth's mantle. For example, this is the most common way that if we move something up very quickly, it decompresses. The release of the pressure would reduce the melting temperature of the rock. However, because if the movement is very fast, there is not much time for the heat to diffuse out. So you follow this adiabatic line, and eventually it would cross the solidus curve, and then you make a melt. There are other ways to make a melt. For example, if you introduce volatiles, for example, water, you can actually reduce the melting temperature like this, and you could get melting. The third way would be, for some reason, you can increase the temperature of the mantle, then you can get melting. So there are examples for these scenarios. For example, we have decompression melting beneath the mid-ocean ridges and also the ocean islands. And also, this melting is probably helped by the higher temperature of the mantle plumes. There are also hydrogen melting in the subduction zones. So melting in these regions has been was very nicely covered by Espen's lecture. You can go back to see his lecture, and that would not be the focus of my talk today. There are also other types of melting that could happen really deep inside Earth. For example, during the formation, early days of Earth, right after the giant impact, the Earth might be heated up significantly. I'm sure Sarah and Mickey can tell you more about these processes. Because of this highly energetic event, the entire mantle could be molten. And from these models by Labrosse et al., there could be even leftover primordial melting today. There are other processes inside the deep Earth, for example, that could cause melting. For example, there could be, because of the solubility of water is different in transition zone minerals than in upper mantle and lower mantle minerals, there could be dehydration induced melting close to transition zone. There are also other melts, like metallic melts, could be possibly inside the deep mantle. This is a recent study by Smith et al. They discovered iron, carbon, and sulfur melts in diamond inclusions, suggesting that there might be metallic melts in the deeper deep mantle. And this study by Liu et al. From the Jackie Lee's group at Michigan, they determined melting temperature for iron carbon system and realized that the solidus of that system is actually lower than the mantle geotherm. So if there is carbon, it could react with these iron in the lower mantle that's caused by the disproportionation of iron 2 plus. Eventually, you could have some iron carbon liquid in the mantle. Okay, so why do we care about melt and melting? I see a question there. Yes.
So iron carbide melt, would they sink or would they be captured? If they would sink, then you get
right,
rid of them.
Right, that's a good question. So it would probably depends on the dihedral angle of iron carbon in say bridge magnet system. I'm not sure that's well studied. So if you have a low dihedral angle, the melt completely wets the grain boundaries, then it's probably easier for the melt to leak through the mantle assemblages and then eventually recycle to the core.
If it's captured in the mantle, would they produce enough, for example, seismic attenuations so that our seismologist can see it or not?
It's possible. I can, well, for metallic liquids, the first of all, the velocity is already lower, much lower than mantle minerals in terms of velocity. And if it melts, it's possible.
There was a CIDR publication from 2 years ago about exactly the, well, metallic droplets kind of suspended in mantle flow explaining the LERPs. This is like Zhang Zhou. Yeah, his paper.
Okay. So understand melting, that would help us to understand the chemical evolution of Earth. All these first order chemical differentiation processes on Earth are related to melting, including core formation, formation of crust. And also, we know that all the heat producing elements and also volatiles, they all like melt. So when you have melting process, they tend to go into melt and then got redistributed into other reservoirs of Earth. So that's very important for the chemical evolution of Earth. And also, we need to know the physical properties of melt because that helps to understand, for example, the composition of the core, which we still don't really understand well. And also it helps to understand the chemical heterogeneities in the mantle. That would help to explain seismic anomalies, velocity anomalies, attenuation, and anisotropy. And also, when we understand melting, we also understand the reverse process, that's the solidification process or crystallization. So that helps us to understanding the secular cooling of Earth, for example, how the Earth magma ocean was cooled and how the outer core is cooling and how that would help to produce the magnetic field on Earth. There are a lot of great lectures in the past CIDR workshops. I've listed some of them. You can see pretty much every year there is a talk related to melting or melt. They have covered the thermodynamics, melting, melting in planetary interiors, melting related to volatiles, rheology, all kinds of things, and also geochemistry, of course. So today, of course, in this CIDR, we have also seen lectures by Esteban and Lars on some aspects of melting. And also, I expect Chris Sanlu, she will talk about element partitioning. For that, you can't avoid melt. So in this lecture, I will talk about melting through a physics perspective. So I will talk about the physics of melting and the physical properties, especially the equilibrium state of melt, and also the solidification process of melts. Okay, so first the physics of melting. So what's melting? As you can see this movie here, this is the melting of ice. At the beginning, you see a perfect periodic crystalline structure. Okay, and when you heat it up with increasing temperature, eventually it lost its periodic structure and becomes amorphous. Okay, this is the melting process. And for solid, we know it has a crystalline lattice structure. Everything is periodically repeated. But for a liquid, you don't have that periodic structure, so we say it has no long-range order. But it has some short-range order, as I will show you in this slide. So we can do X-ray diffractions, X-ray diffraction measurements of a material in a lab, especially at a synchrotron facility like APS. So when you do an X-ray diffraction measurement, basically, when you have a periodic structure, lattice structure, what you see is, in terms of X-ray signals, you got these sharp peaks. It's like you take a Fourier transform of the structure, and then you get the spectrum. And because it's periodically repeated itself in space, you have these peaks. Okay. Now, if you do the same measurements on a liquid, what you see is that you don't have these sharp peaks anymore, but you have these bumps. Okay. But this is a direct X-ray measurement, which do not tell us too much information, unless, of course, it contains all the information about the liquid structure, but it's not direct. We can take a Fourier transform from that and get this so-called pair distribution function, or radial distribution function, to be precise. What this means is that this function is the probability to find an item at a distant r from the origin. Okay, so at the beginning, when r is very small, you don't see another item. Because it's too close, you can't have items overlap with each other. So when you move further, you have this first neighboring shell, and that gives you this large bump here. This is called the first coordination shell. And in fact, if you take an integration from here to here, just under this peak here, you get the coordination number for this item. Basically, that's the number of the first number of items in the first neighboring shell. And then you go further, you get another shell, but your probability of finding an item is lower because you have this amorphous structure. It's a little bit more chaotic. And you go further away, it becomes more and more chaotic. Eventually, the probability would be just the same because everything averages out. Okay, that's why you get, this is a normalized function, that's why you get one here. But the point is that if this were a solid material, what you see is that one peak, a second peak, a third peak, it would be just peaks because you have a structure, a long-range structure. But here for liquid, you don't have that. But you do have this short-range structure here, and that's the short-range order in the liquids. And we studied these structures for Earth-related liquids. For example, this is for liquid iron at high pressure, and this is for liquid dioxide, which is calcium, magnesium, silicon oxide.
That's a question.
Yes.
So I understand that you have the continuum as R increases, but also in your plot you're in nanometers. So is there, within like a glass of water, is this like first and second coordination, like a structure repeated many times?
What do you mean by
so,
repeat?
Well, you have this like this coordination,
yeah.
This probability.
Yeah.
And it radiates from, I guess, the center?
I think probably, I hope I understand you. What happens is that you choose this as your origin, you get this neighboring shell. But if, say, you pick this atom as your origin, you get this neighboring shell.
Okay, okay.
So you get glass water, you take X-ray diffraction, and everything got stacked together, and then you get this. Make sense? Yes.
So I can see how this works well when you have, you know, nice little sphere or all the same atoms like on the diagram on the left. But for the case of the diopside there, calcium and silicon or magnesium
right.
will have different size, I suppose. So is there a way to kind of differentiate between them?
So there is. It's more a lot more complicated actually. For a single element. It's really easy, but for this you actually need to define distribution functions for each different pair. For example, silicon oxygen pair, or oxygen oxygen pair. Then you get different radio distribution functions.
So there is a way to
yeah.
measure.
Yeah. So you get partial distribution functions, but in terms of experiments, it's actually very challenging to do that. In terms of computation, you can always figure that out.
So if we want to fit the peak position of the pair distribution function, what is the best equation to describe this the shape of this peak?
That depends on the liquid property. You can't just use a unified equation to fit that. And quite often, the easiest function would be you assume a hard sphere liquid, meaning that all the atoms are rigid, they don't overlap with each other, and then there is no interaction between them. And that fully captures, pretty much captures the repulsive part of the potential, and then you use that, you can sometimes get a pretty decent fit. But it really depends on what liquid you have, and you may not be able to know the exact structure, and may not be able to, because for liquids, we don't have a very good theory at the moment, so that's very hard. Okay, any more questions? Okay, let's move on. So before I get into details of thermodynamics, I want to list different types of melting theories. First, first type is the theories that based on thermodynamic conditions that the free energies of solids and liquids are equal at melting. Okay, so one example is that from that we can derive the Clausius-Clapeyron relation. The second type of melting theory is based on the solid properties. You study the stability of solids close to the melting point, and it's possible because of the high temperature, the solids becomes unstable, and eventually that breaks down, and then you say that it's melting. And one theory falls into this category is called the Lindemann's law of melting. And also there are more empirical relationships that people make experiments, and then they summarize their data, and then they fit their data using these empirical relations. So I've talked about these. So first, let's look at some thermodynamic properties of liquids. So Lars has introduced the thermodynamic relations, and I won't repeat that. But here, we have this entropy that's related to the heat capacity of a material. So heat capacity is basically when you heat something up, you need some heat. Okay, and the heat you supplied in order to heat something up, that's the heat capacity or specific heat, depends on what unit you're using. And that's also related to the temperature derivative of entropy. Okay, so you integrate this, you get your entropy. Of course, heat capacity is a function of temperature. And when you want to determine the entropy at a certain temperature, you have to integrate this equation from the absolute zero Kelvin. Okay, so this is what's shown here. This figure shows the heat capacity for several minerals, mineral compositions. As a function of temperature. So here we have, in this region, because of temperature is high, we have liquids here. And in this region, before these samples are all glass samples. So before increasing temperature, they are kind of in the frozen state. You can think of a glass as a frozen liquid. It's just like a snapshot of a liquid. But because of this, they have much lower heat capacities. And actually, the heat capacity of glasses are close to the heat capacity of crystals. And at high temperature for crystals, there is actually a classical limit for that, which is 3R. And what you see here is that liquids have higher heat capacities than solid materials and also than glass materials. And this has been shown in Lars' lecture also. So because of this, when you integrate heat capacity with temperature, you get entropy, and you get higher entropy in liquids than in the crystals. Okay, so here I plot the Gibbs free energy as a function of temperature and also as a function of pressure. And we know that entropy is the temperature derivative of the Gibbs free energy with a minus sign here. So with increasing temperature, you get higher entropy. So this becomes steeper and steeper. And also for liquid, as we just saw, liquid has a higher entropy than solid. So you have a steeper curve for liquid than the solid here. And at this temperature, these two curves cross each other, and this would be the melting temperature. So below this temperature, what you have is that the solid has a lower Gibbs free energy, and at temperature higher than this melting point, the liquid has a lower Gibbs free energy. Okay, and if you see the plot of G as a function of pressure, the slope would be the volume of the material. And liquids has a larger volume than solid, typically. Of course, when I talk about volume, it means, volume per mole or volume per atom. So what happens here is that when you at lower pressure, you get the liquid form, and higher pressure, you get the solid form. And you go from the blue line, blue curve here, to red curve here across this this point. And what you find is actually a discontinuity in terms of entropy and volume. And these are the first order derivatives of the Gibbs free energy. So that's why melting is sometimes called a first order phase transition. It's because the first order derivatives of G are discontinuous across the melting point. Okay, so now we apply the thermodynamic rules. Basically, during the phase, the melting process, the change of Gibbs free energy is zero. So liquids have the same Gibbs free energy as solids at the melting point. And what you have is you rearrange this, and then you get that equation like this. And this is called the Clausius-Clapeyron relation. Okay, basically, this is the equation you get, and the slope of this equation is related to the volume of melting, delta Vm here, and the entropy of melting, delta S sub m here. So the volume of melting is the volume difference between the liquid phase and solid phase at the melting point, and entropy of melting is the entropy difference. Okay, so we have an equation here, but this is very difficult to quantify because it's very hard to measure the entropy in a material. When you do calorimetry measurements, it's very hard to determine the heat capacity of a material, especially at high temperature and at high pressure conditions. So we don't actually always get these entropy differences. So it's pretty much very hard to use these equations to study melting. But on the other hand, this sometimes tells us interesting information about a system. For example, this slope is given by the ratio of delta V to delta S, and we know that liquid always has a higher entropy than solid, as we just saw in the heat capacity measurement. So delta S is always larger than zero. Now, when you look at melting curves, most time they have positive slopes in the temperature and pressure plot. That's because liquid is usually less dense than a solid, and so you have larger volume for liquid, and delta V term is also positive. So this is positive. But sometimes you do see these phase diagrams like shown here. This is a work done by Li et al., also from Jackie Lee's group at Michigan. They measure the melting curve of carbon, calcium carbonate, and they show a negative slope here, which suggests that under these pressure conditions, the density of a calcium calcite liquid must be higher than the density of a calcium carbonate solid under these conditions. Okay, so now let's talk about the second type of melting theory. And one example for that is called the Lindemann's law of melting. So in this type of theory, you assume that melting occurs when the vibration of atoms is at a critical fraction of the distance of the nearest neighbors, What this means is that we have this perfect crystal structure of a solid at zero Kelvin. But when you increase temperature, you basically supply some energy to the system, some heat to the system, and the atoms would absorb heat, and then they would start to gain some kinetic energy. That means the atoms would vibrate around their equilibrium positions. Okay, and with increasing temperature further, these vibrations become more and more violent, and eventually, the vibration amplitude is large enough sometimes to overcome the chemical bonding in the material, and then you have melting. So here we use a criterion by quantified by this Lindemann's factor F, saying that to a certain number of F, we consider the solid is molten. Okay, and then we can use something called the Debye's approximation for the solid. In this theory, basically, we consider, for example, the solid material as a crystal lattice with a lot of atoms, and then they have interactions, and then we can think about their interactions in terms of harmonic approximation. That means we basically connect all the atoms using elastic springs, okay? And then they vibrate around them. And then you can make further approximation. You think of this elastic system as a continuous medium, just like what you do in seismology. And what you get is actually three velocities, one P wave velocity and two S shear wave velocities. And it turned out if you use that, you can actually pretty good approximate the properties of a solid at high temperatures. Okay, and in this Debye's model, there is a characteristic frequency called Debye's frequency. This frequency is basically the cutoff frequency that you have the same amount, same number of elastic vibration modes as in the like the real actual spectroscopy measurements. Okay. You don't have to worry about this, but if you're interested, you can check out any solid state physics book. But from this frequency, you can actually define a temperature. Okay, this temperature is basically the temperature required to excite something to that frequency, and that's called the Debye temperature. And the amplitude of this atom vibration is related to the frequency and also the Debye temperature. Now, if you substitute this and equal these two equations, what you get is actually the temperature here. That would be the melting temperature, and as a function of all these various parameters, okay? F is the Lindemann's factor, which we consider a constant. KB is the Boltzmann constant. H bar is the Planck constant divided by 2 pi. Multiplied by 2 pi. Divided by 2 pi. And then M is the mean atomic mass, and V is the mean atomic volume, and theta is the Debye temperature. Okay, this is very simple relationship. So if you know the Debye temperature and basically the mean atomic mass and the basically density of the material, you can calculate the melting temperature. And you may think that Tm depends on volume as a to the power of 2/3, but actually it's not, because the Debye temperature is also a function of volume or density. So we define this parameter that's called Greenison parameter as the density or volume dependence of the Debye frequency, and that's same as the density or volume dependence of the Debye temperature. So you substitute this into this equation and take derivative of this, you get a derivative differential form of this equation. Very simple, like this. Okay, now this is just theory. We have to, and it's kind of empirical because there are parameters we don't know. For example, F, we don't know. And that has to rely on experiments, and people have conducted melting experiments on different materials. It turned out for many metals, F is about 0.08, which supports the theory because for several materials, you can just use only single factor. And if you do more experiment, it turned out F depends on the crystal structure of the material. And for perovskite oxides, F is about 0.13. Now this is one study by Lars to calculate the melting temperature in super-Earth exoplanets. Okay, for the pressures involved in these planets, the pressures are just too high that we can't have any experimental results, and it's hard to just extrapolate our experimental results to such high pressures. And so what Lars did here was to calculate actually the Debye temperature at high pressures, and use the Lindemann's law to get the melting curve at very high pressures. And this F is actually calibrated by the melting temperature at Coal-Mantle boundary conditions to be consistent with experimental results. And that is 0.137, which is actually pretty close to the number I mentioned in last slide. Let me just go back. So this is all nice. You can do some predictions, but still, this is a theory, and it's kind of semi-empirical. And you should always, when you do any extrapolations, you have to always be careful, and eventually it has to be confirmed by experiments. So now let's move on the third type of theories. These are the...
Sorry to interrupt, but I have a question for the previous slide.
Yes.
Left-hand side is silicate and right-hand side is iron.
Yes.
You intentionally... so could you, because there are way more data there to really high pressure, so most of them are from shockwave or on the right hand side? Yes.
So this is Darmanin cell, that's shockwave.
10 megabar?
No, this is only here. And I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's
Those red triangles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
While we're on this figure, what is the dotted line and what is the solid line? And
oh, the solid line, that's the calculation for the melting curve, and the dotted line is the correction when you add other components to the system. That's kind of the the depression of the melting curve by introducing other materials. Okay. So we can approximate Lindemann's law, which is here, with a finite difference equation. For example, log t would be delta t over t, and log rho would be delta v over v. And you get the equation like this. Okay. Of course, you know for finite difference theory, it has to be, it can only be valid around this neighborhood when you do the, this type of approach. So when you do that, you have a temperature relation, that temperature as a function of volume change. And there is a constant here. Okay, and this is called the Crout-Kennedy equation. Basically, temperature is a linear function of the fractional change of volume. Okay, but because of this practice you see here, it means that this probably cannot be used at very high pressures. Of course, this equation was first derived by fitting on their experimental data, not just from this theory. But when you do this, it makes sense why this equation worked at the first place. Okay, so this equation works for several metals. As you can see, temperature is a linear function of the volume change. But for ionic crystals and also for minerals, they don't work as well. You see a curvature here. So they can be only valid at very low volume change or compression. The last equation I will talk about is called the Simon-Glatzel equation. So again, starting from Lindemann's law, you combine this equation with the Murnaghan equation state. This is simply, Bach modulus is a linear function of pressure. That's the assumption we use when we derive Murnaghan equation state. And you combine these two and consider the definition of Bach modulus, eventually you get an equation like this, if you integrate this. Okay? So what you see here is a power law relationship between temperature and pressure. And this is called the Simon's law, or sometimes called referred to as the Simon-Glatzel equation. Again, this was also first derived empirically, but there seems to be some connection with the Lindemann's law. And this one actually was quite widely used when people interpret melting temperature of water materials. For example, this figure shows a recent work by Anzalini et al. They measured the melting temperature of pure iron, and then they used Simon's law to interpret the curvature of the melting curve. Oh, I'm probably too slow. Now let's talk about a binary system. We'll talk about a single component system. So we have seen this, that the entropy of a mixture is actually given by the number of configurations. For example, you have a material that has different sites, site A and site B, and then you mix material items on different sites, then you get these numbers of different configurations. And this one can be approximated by this equation. Okay? And this is called the entropy of mixing. And this is, in terms of ideal solution model, this is completely symmetrical. Okay, when you have pure component, this term becomes zero. Now, when you consider the Gibbs free energy of a mixture, what you have is that you have the Gibbs free energy from each pure component, and then you have the entropy of mixing. And for ideal solution, you don't have the entropy, the enthalpy of mixing, but only the entropy of mixing. Okay, and then when you plot G as a function of the concentration of component B, what you have is an equation like this. Okay, the pure component free energy would be these two points, and this would be the lowering of free energy due to mixing. When you mix something, nature likes that, and you lower the free energy of the system. Okay, now we also have this Euler form of thermodynamic equations introduced in last lecture. We have the Gibbs free energy as a function of the chemical potentials of each component. We have two components here. And then if you equal these two, what you have are these two equations. Basically, the chemical potential of a component is the chemical potential for the pure A phase plus how much you have how much A you have in that phase. And this is due to the mixing entropy part. Okay? Now for a non-ideal mixing model, you would replace the concentration with activity. But I'm not going to talk about that here. So now let's look at some melting in the binary system. This system is called the eutectic melting. I'm going to use the diopside anorthosis system again. But here I have these compositions so that you can you know what they are. But the point here is that diopside and anorthosis, one has magnesium and one has aluminum, and they have very different ionic radius as shown in Kanani's lecture. So what happens is that because of this big difference, they don't mix into each other. You don't form a solid solution like an alloy, but instead you have a mechanical mixture of these two phases. Okay, it's still just two minerals when you mix them. So when you write the chemical potential for the system, for example, for the solid phase, you would have diopside in the solid phase and as pure diopside in the solid phase, because you don't have any anorthosis in this phase. Now for the liquid, things are different. Diopside liquid and anorthosis liquid would completely mix into each other. You don't get two liquids, but just one liquid. So what you have is that the diopside component in the liquid phase, the chemical potential would equal to diopside in the liquid as a pure phase, pure diopside liquid, plus this mixing term. And that's related to the concentration of diopside in the liquid. Okay, now we apply the melting rule that the chemical potential of diopside in the solid would be the same as the chemical potential of diopside component in the liquid. Okay, that's how we get melting. And you solve this equation. Okay, so what you have is actually you rearrange this, you have the concentration of dioxide in the liquid as a function of this, and this happens to be the Gibbs free energy of mixing, and which is also related to the enthalpy of mixing and also the melting temperature of dioxide. Okay, and you can write it in a different way like this, but these are the same. When you plot this equation on this phase diagram, what you see is actually the melting temperature decreases with increasing anorthite. The melting temperature should decreases with decreasing dioxide concentration in the liquid. So you get a curve like this from this equation. Of course, this is only half the story. I have two other equations about anorthite component. They are completely symmetrical to this, and what you get is another equation like this, and then you get a curvature like this. And they cross each other, and that point is your eutectic composition. Okay, so so what we have here is called a eutectic phase diagram. What happens is that, for example, when you have a bulk composition like this, you increase the temperature. In this region, you have both minerals mixed, mechanically mixed, and at this temperature, you would start to melt. And first, you would form a liquid at this eutectic composition, and also a solid, an anorthite solid. Okay, and you increase the temperature, your liquid composition changes, but not for the solid. So eventually, you reach this point, everything is completely molten, and the composition of the system goes back to the original composition. And this is equilibrium melting or batch melting. Yes.
So it looks like on the anorthite side, the curve line, like the liquiders is curved at their like 90% of the anorthite. Why is that? Like, because for dioxide.
Well, this is not the diagram I produced. It's probably like this, but maybe there is some nonlinear mixing if you consider then it may become like that.
So now here is not there.
But if you just use these equations, you probably don't get this curvature. Okay.
So it's not ideal solution at that.
Yeah. This plot is probably more actual plot. But I'm talking about the ideal mixing model.
Thank you.
So I had to be quick. So for the solid solution system. Here I use the example of olivine. So there is phosphorite olivine and ferrite olivine. These are the magnesium and iron ion members. So in this case, what happens is that iron and magnesium have comparable ionic radius, so they can completely mix. So you get a solid solution here, and then you have a liquid solution here. So you have the equations, they look very similar for both the liquid phase and the solid phase. Oops. Now during melting, you equal these two equations, you get an equation like this for the phosphorite component. But just based on this equation, you will not be able to solve it. Because you have these two unknowns here, okay, and then you can add another equation from the ferrite side, and then you have in total four unknowns, two equations. Of course, there are relations that the total concentration, you add everything together, it has to be one. So with these four equations, you can solve these, and what you get are two curves. One is here, and one is here, shown by these equations. And remember, the entropy, mixing free energy is written like this. So you have a temperature variable here. Okay. So I want to point out in this figure is that when you melt, for example, a material like this, so you start with here, and when you melt it, the first melt would be here, and solid would be here. You actually have different compositions between the melt and the solid. And from this plot, we see that iron is more enriched in the liquid than in the solid. And people studied this. They defined the iron magnesium distribution between the melt and olivine, and then they define a distribution constant called KD like this. Smaller KD means more iron in the melt, which is actually very important parameter, because when we talk about melt in the deep earth, we want to understand if that's stable or gravitational stable enough. In order to have high density, you have to have higher iron content in the liquid. And smaller KD would help with that. So these are some experimental studies for KD as a function of pressure. They are in the range of 0.25 to 0.4 at high pressures. So more iron will be partitioned into the liquid. There are other forms of phase diagrams. These are can get more complicated. For example, for the solid phase, some solid may partially dissolve into another solid phase, and then you get lines like these. These are called solvus. And sometimes you have two volatiles. They don't mix at low temperatures, but mix at high temperatures. So you have two liquids or two fluids at low temperatures, and these are called immiscible liquids. Okay, so now this figure shows a pseudo-binary phase diagram. So-called pseudo means that silicate has more components than one. So, but if we plot them together, on this side we have silicate, and then this side we have water or hydrogen. Water or another volatile. What happens here is that at low temperature, the volatile, it's still volatile. It becomes like at high temperature, relatively high temperature, it becomes like a fluid. And at this temperature, what you have is actually a fluid that had some silicate inside, but it's still a fluid. And then you have a silicate melt that has some volatiles inside, for example, some hydrous melt, but they don't mix with each other. So you could have a material like this. You have fluid that's separated with the melt in this region. And then when you keep increasing pressure, what happens is shown here. When you increase pressure, this critical curve would change. Eventually, you have a phase diagram like this. So you have silicate and then a volatile here, and you have basically one fluid phase, and that's called the supercritical fluid. Okay, we don't care if that's a vapor phase or a melt phase. It's just a fluid because we don't know what it is. It's dense enough to be distinguished from a vapor, but less dense probably than a melt. Now there are other complications. For example, a phase like acetate may not, when it melts, it does not melt into acetate melt, but instead it melts into a liquid that's different than the anesthetized composition and faster, right? Okay, this is a zoom in version. So you have anesthetized here, and then when you have your eutectic temperature here, it melts into a liquid that's different than anesthetized, and you have also phosphorite here. But this behavior changes with pressure. When you go to, for example, the Kalman-Mantel boundary condition or high pressure conditions, eventually to the Kalman-Mantel boundary conditions, anesthetized would melt into an anesthetized liquid. And this is called congruent melting, and this behavior is called incongruent melting. Okay, so what happens here is actually the eutectic composition is pretty close to the pyrolyte composition, meaning that if you have melt at the base of the mantle, it would pretty much have similar composition as its original composition, and likely we don't have a large range for the partial melt to exist. So if there is a melt layer, it must be a thin layer. Okay. And then there are multiple component system, then it's harder to plot. Question.
Can I ask a question about the slide before?
Yeah.
So you said that the one with this one. Yeah. So you were talking about melting pyrolyte essentially. But if we would have Hartzsprungite and basalt at the Kalman-Mantel boundary.
Right. So what happens if you have Hartzsprungite, it melts, you get some solid here and then liquid will be here. If you have basalt, you would get silica on this side. Or if your composition is here, it would melt as like the eutectic composition. If you have some here, then you get a little bit silica and then this liquid here. Okay, so for this, I want to point you out there are many minerals in a rock, and what happens is that you have a phase that's the last that would get into the melt, and that's called the liquidous phase. And here it's olivine at low pressures. Olivine will melt last. And then with increasing pressure, of course, you don't have olivine anymore, and eventually the liquidous phase will change to garnet. Let me give you some examples of study of melting temperatures. This is a recent paper by Serafin et al. They measured the solidus temperature of a mantle pyrolusite. They have been very careful about the water content in the liquid, because when you add water, you change the entropy and you lower the melting curve. So they have been very careful of that, and then eventually they get a mantle potential temperature that's about 60 degrees higher than before. It's not much, but when you study the melting processes under middle ocean ridges, it could be important. This is another study to study the melting of pyrolyte composition in the lower part of the mantle, and they use tomography of the melt as a criterion to find the melting. These are thermodynamic cell studies, and then they got much lower solidus for the melting curve than before. I'm showing this is just to show you that these are very challenging experiments, and there are a large discrepancy in experimental data, and these are still ongoing work when we look at these data. And also it's true for the melting curve of iron that has been measured many, many times, but still we have discrepancies. As you see in this plot, there are many curves, many data points, and they don't agree with each other. This is another study at a relatively lower pressures, and then you see these discrepancies, and these differences can be large. Okay, I have 20 minutes. Let me see how fast I can go. So we talk about melting, and now let's understand more about liquid melt properties. And the reason we want to understand this is that we want to know how stable melt can be in the mantle, because usually melt, when you melt something at low pressure, the melt density is smaller than the solid. But with increasing temperature, melts are usually more compressible than solid. So the density of melts increases with pressure faster than solid. And this was first pointed out by Ed Stoper in 1981 that there might be a density crossover in the upper mantle that melt could become denser than a solid. So the reason for this is that melts and solids have very different properties. So if we compare the density of melt and solids at ambient conditions for various different compositions, what you see is that melts are have slightly lower densities than solids. And this is one-to-one curve. On this side, the melts are lighter. But if you compare the Bach modulus, which is the inverse of compressibility for a material, if you have a higher Bach modulus, material is less compressible. What you see is that the liquids have much smaller Bach modulus than the corresponding solids, and they are much more compressible. Okay, so we want to determine the density of a liquid in order to compare with solid materials. We can, for example, we can use an empirical equation state like this one. That's the Birch-Monaghan equation state introduced in last lecture. And in this equation state, you have these parameters like rho naught, kt naught, k prime naught. These are the ambient density and Bach modulus and derivative pressure derivative Bach modulus. So for liquids, we can actually model this using the ideal mixing model. There are many studies, especially in Becky Van's group. They have the extensive work on these, and basically you determine the partial molar volume and partial molar pressure derivative of volumes like this for each melt component, like MgO component or SiO2 component, and then you do a linear mixing, and then you get the rho zero and k zero here. So now you get your anchoring points for the Birch-Monaghan equation state. The only thing left to know is the pressure derivative of Bach modulus. And this has to be constrained by high temperature density measurements. So for these, you can do various type of experimental work. Shown here is so-called sink float experiment. You put a marker inside a liquid. If it sinks, the marker is denser. If it floats, the liquid is denser. And you do this at different pressures, and then you get sink and float cases, and then you can bracket density at high pressure. There are other techniques, for example, X-ray diffraction, X-ray absorption techniques, or shock wave measurements. You can get density. But once you have this density point, you know that the intercept here, and then you know the slope of this curve. You determine the curvature, which is k prime. And you do this for many liquids, silicate liquids. what you find is actually there seems to be some systematics between K-prime and the silicon content in the melt. Okay, with increasing silicon content, you have smaller K-prime, and then you have the melt becomes more compressible, which means like for a basaltic melt, it's more compressible at high pressure than a pyrolite melt. And this is likely related to the continuous coordination change of the SiO2 component in the melt. But there is a problem with this study, because we use limited number of density points at high pressure, and then we constrain K prime sometimes. And there is a large trade-off between these, and they have large uncertainties. As you can see here, there are large uncertainties in K prime. It could be 4, it could be 8. To constrain that, we can actually use some other techniques like this ultrasonic sound velocity measurement. We can, like indoor seismology, we put a transducer, produce some elastic waves that would propagate through the sample, and then we measure travel time like a seismogram, and then we measure the length at a synchrotron lab. Then we can determine velocity. And from velocity, we know the Bach modulus, and then we can get better understanding of the equilibrium state. These show the velocity of liquid diopside as a function of pressure. And these are the velocities for diopside glass, and these are for diopside solid. So what you see is that liquid has much lower velocity than either glass or solid. And sometimes people want to use glass as analog materials to study the compressional properties of liquids, thinking that glass is also an amorphous material and you can approximate liquid, but you can't do that. For example, for glass, you have shear velocities, but you don't observe any shear velocities in a liquid. And you do this, and you get much better constraint for the K and K prime. But still, there are other problems with the Birch-Monaghan equilibrium state. For example, for each melt composition, I had to have some experiments in order to determine K prime. I've shown a systematic of K prime with silica content, but we don't know about the effect of other components. And also, this is derived just based on thermodynamics, and it does not have any physics inside related to melt. So when we look at the equilibrium state, we can go back from Helmholtz free energy, which is the internal energy subtracted by the entropy part. So the equilibrium state is basically you take volume derivative of this, you get two components. One is the energy contribution, and one is the entropy contribution. And for solid material that I mentioned in the Debye's model, you can think of springs connect the atoms, and then you have the harmonic approximation. And eventually, what you have is this term that depends on the interatomic distance of the solid material. And this term, that's the thermal pressure term, that's a correction to the equilibrium state. That's usually small compared to the energy term. So what this means is that for solid materials, the compression property is really determined by its interatomic distance or the molar volume. And that's how you get the Birch's law, in which case the velocity of a material is simply a function of density. Of course, it also depends on the its mean atomic weight. But you get linear relation between velocity and density. It doesn't matter what temperature or pressure are. Once you know the density, meaning you know the interatomic distance, you know the velocity or bulk modulus. However, when you plot liquid data into this Birch law type of plot, you have velocity here and density here. These lines shows the diopside solid. What you see is that liquid is has much lower velocity, and they are much more compressible than solid. And also, compared to glass, they're much more compressible. So there must be some other compression mechanisms for liquids, and turns out there has to be the entropy component, as we saw the entropy of liquid is higher than the entropy of solid. And this is also supported by the pressure dependence of Greenison parameter, as shown in Lars' talk. You see that the Greenison parameter increases with volume or decreases with pressure for solid materials, but decreases with volume for liquid materials. And if you assume materials follow Birch's law, this is the definition of Greenison parameter, and then you can write it as a function of volume like this. And for Birch's law material, K prime are about the same as this parameter. So this term cancels out, and Greenison parameter is just proportional to V. But for liquid, you don't have that relation, which suggests that the liquid do not follow the Birch law, and the entropy component must be.
I have important. A quick question. Yes. So you say when liquids don't follow Birch's law, do you mean specifically silicate liquids? What would happen about, like, in the outer core?
That's a very good question. I think for metallic liquids, they are actually quite different than like ionic liquids in that the properties are mostly controlled by the electronic, the free electrons in the metals. I don't have detailed compression between these two, but I suspect there would be some difference, because for solid iron, first of all, you have shear velocity, but for liquid iron, you don't have shear velocity. But of course, if you correct the difference in density, I don't know how that would change the Birch's law plot. I have to look at that in detail. But metallic liquids in general are different than silicate liquids. Yeah,
because I mean, seismologically, you know, we can kind of make these plots as well of velocity and density. And when we do that for the outer core, it does seem to follow Birch's law. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. That's like observation, right? Yeah. So yeah, that may be true. But I don't have experimental data at such high pressure, and I haven't followed those literature closely. So I'll check for those. So here we have a new equation state based on the physics of liquid, which is called the hot sphere model. And we have three terms. First one is related to the entropy term. You can see this term is just look like an ideal gas equation state. And then there is an attraction term, and which is related to the Coulombic interaction, and then there is a repulsive force term. And now we can use this equation state to reproduce all the density data, bulk modulus data, and also we can explain the Greenison parameter behavior very nicely. But with Birch Monaghan equation state, you will not be able to do that. And also we compare we can determine the sphere diameters in this model. We found that there is a correlation between the sphere diameters for different components with their bond lengths obtained from the ionic radius. So this is a support for the model because we know that the liquid has a short range order, and this relationship shows that. There is some further development by Wu et al. Along this line of research, and in this model, they model the coordination of cations explicitly in the liquid, and then they can actually calculate coordination number as a function of compression, and then they can also explain the Greenism parameter behavior. But currently, the model is only from available to NGO melt because it requires a lot of solid material data. So I don't have much time. I'll be quick on this one. So we also want to study the solidification of melt. And here we want to, again, compare the liquidus curve with the adiabat. If the liquidus curve is steeper than the adiabat, it would so the adiabat is basically temperature in the liquid. So during the cooling of the material of the liquid layer, you would have this cross first at the higher pressure part. So you would have, say, if this happens inside the Earth's core, it would mean that the core would started to crystallize in the center and grow outwards. If you have opposite relations between these two slopes, then you would have a snowing core. Similar concepts apply to silicate magma ocean, and then you compare the adiabat and the liquid curves, and all these studies point to a starting point somewhere in the mid mantle instead of the top or the bottom of the mantle. I think I'll skip these. There are different models for planetary cores. Some would show like snowing cores, and some would show growing cores. So I'm going to skip this to this last slide. This is a very interesting recent study by Ludo Hugo et al. At Case Western Reserve. What they pointed out is there is some kinetic effects related to solidification process. When you cool something, if it's homogeneous, sometimes you don't get the nucleus to crystallize. So it's just like when you cloud, sometimes you don't get rain because you don't have the particles for the water to grow, to condense. So this same thing is true when you imagine like the Earth's core, originally everything was in the liquid form, and then you start to cool the core. Since it's so homogeneous, you can't find a good nucleus inside to crystallize from that. So you could have supercooling. It turned out for iron at that pressure, you need 1,000 Kelvin supercooling in order to crystallize the core homogeneously. So that, but of course, we know there is inner core inside the Earth. So this causes a paradox. How did the core cool down crystallize into the inner core in the first place? How could we introduce heterogeneous nucleation sites inside the liquid core? I'll stop here. Thank you.
So in this particular case, could light elements do something for that?
Actually, it's difficult. It depends on the dihedral angle between the solid iron, the iron liquid and iron solid. Maybe, but it's very difficult to do these type of experiments. So I don't know. In this paper, likely scenario would be something metallic in the mantle eventually dropped into the core, into the liquid core, but that was already supercooled a little bit. And then you drop something metal, solid, and that's large enough to survive the remelting at the outer core, eventually enters into the center, and that could crystallize. But that's just one hypothesis.
I think you explained things too well. Like, I didn't have a question about the eutectic this time.
Thank you.
Because you had equations.
So if you can flip one more slide back. Probably way back. Yes, the one that you passed. There's a very interesting sort of gap decrease between liquidus and solidus around 30 GPA.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So what I learned from thermodynamics is that if you cool liquid at the eutectic composition, you will bypass the period where you have liquid and solid together. You're going to go from entirely liquid to entirely solid right away by going through eutectic point.
Yeah.
So I wonder if anybody thought about those gap changes as a function of pressure in terms of magma, ocean, solidification.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Or it doesn't matter at all, I don't know. But it's interesting to look at that gap is changing with depth, decreasing, increasing, and then you're cooling magma ocean through it. And if you are lucky enough at some depth to go through eutectic point, because eutectic point changes with pressure, eutectic composition changes with pressure. Sometimes, some point, it actually coincides with pyrolytic composition. That's where you're going to have just entire freeze of liquid right away.
Sounds like a CITER group project.
Yeah.
Composition as a function of pressure. So there's an interesting coincidence of eutectic composition matching pyrolytic composition right at the 660. A couple of measurements that shows that. So I thought someone might have captured it and throw into the model and see what happens. I don't know.
I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but in general,
I think Dan's saying that.
It didn't sound like it was going to go through that path. I don't think the Earth is going to go through that path.
Okay, maybe people are just hungry.
Lunchtime already?
Let's ask questions during lunch. We will not reconvene this afternoon. Instead, we will see you at 9 a.m. on Monday. Take your weekend to enjoy the beach, but also to think about the group projects. Oh, and happy Bastille Day.